Yeah, so I guess I'll just launch right into it. Earlier today, Joseph brought up Weston A. Price, and I'm going to be talking about him a little bit. So in a speech in 1930, the highly respected dentist Weston A. Price warned his audience, quote, "Probably few of the problems concerning the coming generations are more exacting and difficult to meet than the problem of reduction in the minerals and other chemical content of the soil," unquote. So Price was not raising this alarm merely as a layman concerned about resource conservation, separate from his professional work. He saw a direct connection between the prevention of dental decay and the prevention of soil depletion via food and nutrition. So it might seem extraordinary to us today that a dentist would feel comfortable trespassing onto the realm of the agronomist. I mean, we don't see dentists walking around here, especially. But in fact, Price was not conjecturing far from the accepted science of the time. So in the following talk I have here, I hope to show how the growing understanding of nutrition in the first half of the 1900s informed agricultural thinking and vice versa. And I will then focus on the early organic movement and consider why it immediately ran into conflict with mainstream scientific opinion, despite the fact that mainstream scientific opinion and the organic movement shared so much common ground. I'm going to be discussing this common ground in relation with nutrition science. And to conclude, I think some of my conclusions might be a little bit disagreeable to what has come up today already. I haven't really found that the problem was reductionism versus holism. There's differences of emphasis and some historical accidents, but I don't think it was so much this philosophical or epistemological issue that oftentimes comes up. Okay. So first I'll start on nutrition science. When nutrition as a science emerged in the latter half of the 19th century, it bore the heavy imprint of chemistry. Following the pioneering work of the German scientist Justus von Liebig in the mid-1800s, chemists were able to separate foods into proteins, carbohydrates, and fats, and minerals and water as well. Each of these nutrients seemed to perform some unique function, with carbohydrates and fats providing two different kinds of fuel, and the proteins building and repairing tissue. So the metabolic role of the minerals was less well understood, although there was general agreement among scientists that the body should, that foods should contain the minerals that the body did. So since scientists did not yet understand the role of these minerals very closely or even know about vitamins, their knowledge was wielded to some ill effect by dietary reformers in the late 1800s and early 1900s. For example, nutrition experts back then recommended that working class families not waste their scarce money on fruits and vegetables, since their assay methods showed that these foods consisted mostly of water and fiber with a little carbohydrate. But the nutrition field shifted in a new direction beginning in the 1910s up to about the 1940s, following a rapid succession of new discoveries, which one of the leading researchers, E.V. McCollum, called the newer knowledge of nutrition. So the research driving this newer knowledge mostly came from physiology, biochemistry, agricultural science departments, and also from the field of medicine versus chemistry, which had been the case previously. So by the 1940s, researchers had discovered most of the vitamins and minerals necessary for health, and they were beginning to gain an understanding of what they do in the body. The focus of nutrition, in other words, shifted from the quantitative to the qualitative, from the macronutrients like carbohydrates and fats to the micronutrients. So the discovery of the necessity of these micronutrients in human metabolism revealed that certain diseases previously believed to be caused by infectious agents, such as scurvy, rickets, and pellagra, were in fact manifestations of nutritional deficiency. But beyond these acute diseases, nutrition and medical scientists argued over whether poor diet was creating millions of cases of degenerative diseases and subclinical illnesses, even in apparently well-fed countries like the United States and Britain. Many nutrition scientists, I would say the majority of leading nutrition scientists, believed that a significant proportion of the population was eating adequately enough not to require immediate medical care, but they were not eating well enough to enjoy what they called optimal health or, vibrant living. So unsurprisingly, this open-ended definition of what constituted health and illness contributed to what historian Rima Apple has termed vitamania in the public mind. So it isn't too difficult to imagine what it was like back in the 20s and 30s. All you have to do is think about the craze over antioxidants and omega-3 fats these days. They're being put into everything, including water. But however, with the exception of a few products such as cod liver oil, the dietary supplement industry remained relatively minuscule until it exploded during World War II and immediately after. Vitamins were mainly used for therapeutic uses by doctors. So many of the scientists involved with this newer knowledge of nutrition began to look on the dietary patterns of the Western industrialized countries with a certain amount of terror. From roughly the 1870s to the 1920s, several foods became commonplace in the Western diet. So white flour, formerly affordable only to the wealthy, became cheap enough for all classes of society, as did white sugar. Refined vegetable oils and margarine also found their way into the Western diet as a cheaper replacement for the traditional animal fats. Okay, so this is, of course, people know about this. It's starting to fade into the background now that they've discovered the trans fats. But so these refined foods like Crisco and white flour were shelf-stable for long periods of time, and this was a quality that was becoming increasingly important as the route from the farmer to the consumer became more distant and more indirect in this time period. But these foods also happened to be stripped of much of their vitamin and mineral content in the process. So this fact wasn't fully realized until these foods had become well embedded in the Western diet and powerful economic interests had built up around the production and sale. Sometimes in opposition to these business interests and sometimes with their support, nutrition scientists by the 1920s and 30s came to a rough consensus on what dietary changes were most needed in the West. They recommended the liberal consumption of what they called the protective foods that were rich in vitamins and minerals and relatively nutrient dense. The protective foods considered necessary for good health were fresh eggs, dairy products, and meat, especially the organs like liver, which I know a lot of people don't like, but as well as fruits and vegetables. It was hoped that these protective foods would displace or at least compensate for the unprotective foods like refined starches, the sugars, the vegetable fats that dominated the diet of most people at the time. Nutrition scientists also, and this kind of surprised me, but I found nutrition scientists also agreed on the superiority of whole wheat, whole grain products versus refined grain products, but they debated over the likelihood of being able to change popular preference for refined flour. So a handful of nutritional anthropologists like Weston Price seeking a basis for comparison to industrial society, and you already brought up some of these slides earlier today, but I'll just repeat them, found that there are primitive groups around the world that consumed a lot of protective foods, and they were able to avoid the diseases of civilization such as dental decay until they came into contact with modern foods. So here, Weston Price, these are some of the photos he took on his journeys around the world. He found that the diets were extremely varied, but the one common thing, one thing they had in common was that they're all very high in these protective foods. This is in Alaska. This was in Central Africa. This is in Alaska. That's fish roe, salmon. Here he is in the Polynesia. He focused on what foods they're eating. And here's what he found. This was in Switzerland. The switch on the left from the primitive diets to the switch on the right, which is the when they would adopt the modern diet. Wherever he went, same thing. Okay. Okay, so these nutritional discoveries developed to some extent from a logic of their own within the scientific community. But by the 1930s, it became clear that the practical application of the new research, the newer knowledge of nutrition, could have far-reaching political, social, and economic consequences. And in fact, the newer knowledge was used to support a larger contemporary movement seeking to address the agricultural and environmental crises that seemed to be asserting themselves with a lot of force in the 1930s. So I'll briefly discuss these larger contextual issues before going back to how they affected nutrition science. So first, with agriculture, farmers were very badly exposed economically when the Great Depression began in late 1929. Many farmers had overinvested and pushed onto marginal lands during the agricultural boom years of World War I, which was 1914-18, and the years immediately after that. But the bottom fell out of agricultural commodity markets in the early 20s as the war-torn economies recovered. and good harvests were made. But so following the sudden collapse of prices, the terms of trade for farm products partially recovered, but farmers remained highly indebted, and rural outmigration continued through the 1920s. So when the Depression actually did strike in 1929 in the early 30s, demand collapsed, and the real price of agricultural commodities fell faster than interest on mortgage and taxes, resulting in a wave of foreclosures of unprecedented magnitude. So, in the early 1930s, rural protests threatened violence in hard-hit areas, and farmers clamored for government support. I don't know if you've ever seen the photos of farmers actually getting into street fights with riot police in Midwestern states, which is not something we think about now with the farming population. So the atmosphere of crisis in agriculture and in modern civilization more generally was heightened by increasingly visible evidence of widespread soil erosion. There had for a long time been warnings of the threat to society posed by soil erosion and soil-destroying farming practices, but they had relatively little lasting impact on popular consciousness. That might be one of the reasons why, for example, F.H. King's book just kind of fell into obscurity after he wrote it. However, the erosion message was very suddenly brought to national attention by the Dust Bowl, the famous period of severe dust storms during the 1930s on the Great Plains. So dust storms on the plains were, of course, not new, but in that decade, their magnitude, the amount of human misery and the response of the government were new. So the Dust Bowl helped, actually, to advance policies that were already on the table in the 1930s. So efforts to revive rural areas and conserve soil were central to the overall vision of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. Under Roosevelt's presidency, a group of agrarian conservationists arose to positions of power in the Department of Agriculture and a newly created organization such as the Soil Conservation Service, which I think today is under a different name. Anyone?
NRCS.
Thank you. I got my head stuck in the past. So, to these conservationists, the Dust Bowl was only the latest episode in a long history of soil abuse by American farmers. So, beyond addressing the immediate economic emergency of the Depression, these agrarian conservationists believed that the legal relationship of farmers to the land had to change, and also that the exploitative and individualistic pioneer mentality of the American past had to change. They had to be more cooperative with each other. Okay, so aside from these often controversial adjustments in policy, the agrarian conservationists believe that the realization of a nationwide permanent agriculture, as they called it, today we just call it sustainable agriculture, hinged on the widespread adoption of well-known methods for slowing erosion and improving soil fertility, such as contour strip cropping, cover cropping, which we've talked about already, improved pastures, and the reforestation of marginal lands. And so these are just some pictures from the USDA yearbook of agriculture, soils, and men. This was a typical trope they'd use. On the left side, there'd be these eroded fields. I think that's in Kansas. And on the right, they'd show that the restoration that would take place with strip cropping. So these measures generally involved the much greater use of thick-growing and dense-rooted grasses and legumes than had historically been the case with American farmers. The overall aim was to improve the structure and fertility of the soil by increasing its humus content. It was on the subject of building humus content and soil fertility more generally that agriculture and nutrition science crossed paths most clearly in the 1930s. How much time do I have left? Sorry, I forgot to bring up my clock. Uh-oh. I'll just keep going. Okay, so the work of University of Missouri soil scientist William Albrecht perhaps best illustrates how this crossover between agriculture and nutrition science occurred. So Albrecht began his career in the late 1910s by studying the growth and nitrogen-fixing properties of legumes.
You have 25 minutes.
Okay, thanks. When Albrecht began his research, farmers and agricultural scientists widely accepted that applying lime to soils was valuable and an often necessary process for establishing good leguminous crops. The line of reasoning was that since limestone applied to the soil lessens its acidity, and since limestone applied on the soil helps grow legumes, the change in acidity was the cause of the growing legumes. Albrecht led a series of investigations in the 1920s that corrected this misconception. He found that it was the calcium in the lime that acted as a nutrient, that improved the capacity for legumes to grow and for the nodules to fix nitrogen rather than the lime's acidity-fighting property. So Albrecht was actually able to promote legume and root nodule growth in pot and field experiments by applying sources of calcium, such as calcium chloride and calcium sulfate, or gypsum, which did not substantially change or actually increase soil acidity. So Albrecht's work on legumes and calcium accorded well with what soil scientists of the same period had determined regarding broad regional differences in soil types.
Is that the, oh man, you probably can't even read that.
This is also from the same yearbook of agriculture. So just to take an example, in the 1928 classification system of Curtis Marbot, who was the chief of the Bureau of Soils at the time, he used variations in the concentration of calcium carbonate in the horizon of the soil profile as his first and foremost criterion for soil differentiation. He divided the great soil groups of the world into those with and those without a horizon of calcium carbonate accumulation in the solum, or just below it. The availability of calcium to microbes, plants, and animals was central to the soil formation processes that American soil scientists had identified by the 1930s, taking ideas that the Russians had developed earlier. So I'll describe two of these soil formation processes that are most relevant to the subject of nutrition, using the terminology of the time, calcification and podzolization. I can't remember what terms are used these days. Some of this might be common sense to people who've been trained in soil science, but I'm just going to go over them really briefly so I can emphasize the connections between soil science and nutrition. Okay. So the process of calcification is typically maintained under natural grasslands with restricted rainfall, e.g. the Great Plains. The rainfall causes sufficient leaching to move calcium carbonate to just below the soil layer, but not so far that plant roots cannot reach them. The grasses and legumes bring large amounts of calcium to the surface, and in the process use other minerals such as phosphorus and sulfur in much greater amounts. By incorporating these minerals into their tissues, they keep them in a relatively immobile state in the form of organic matter. An abundance of organic matter and minerals, in turn, promotes a high level of bacterial activity, which aids in the production of humus. All soil microorganisms require carbon as fuel, but bacteria have higher requirements than fungi for nitrogen as well as bases such as calcium. Soils rich in minerals thus resulted in heavy and more proteinaceous plant growth, as well as a deep layer of humus-rich soil, according to the soil scientists then. The process of podzolization is dominant in the humid forested regions of the world, such as the eastern half of the United States. Podzolization occurs where there's sufficient moisture throughput to remove the more soluble minerals like calcium and magnesium, and where not enough of them are returned to the surface by the vegetation to prevent the development of acid soil conditions. Like I said, podzols tend to be dominated by forests, which have much lower mineral intake than grassland plants per annum. Lacking these minerals, forest vegetation is composed almost entirely of what William Albrecht called carbonaceous bulk in the form of cellulose and lignin and starches, which is the product of sunlight, air, and water, but with relatively protein synthesis carried out by plants beyond that. The high carbon to nitrogen ratio and lower base content of the organic material resulted in the dominance of fungi over bacteria in forest decomposition processes, which was also slower than on grasslands. And in the southern United States, higher temperatures intensify the weathering and humus-reducing effect of high rainfall, creating the easily exhaustible reddish-brown soils there. So this is the overall vision. I know there's a lot of problems with it, but that's the way they set it in. So from these premises, Albrecht developed a rather distinctive nutritional geography. He didn't use that term. I made it up for him. The process of calcification involved a virtuous ecological cycle, or at least it was virtuous from the perspective of agricultural use, between climate, minerals, nitrogen, bacterial activity, and organic matter. Podzolization, on the other hand, represented a negative one. In their pre-agricultural condition, the grasslands fed the massive herds of bison, whereas the eastern forests could support only more scattered and smaller wildlife. And of course, here again, soil scientists in the 1930s were generally ignored the impact of pre-European humans on the landscape. These differences in soil fertility also mapped onto the regional specializations in agriculture that had developed by the in the first half of the 1900s. So yeah, in the U.S. in the mid-continental grasslands, the mineral-rich soil promoted the growth and reproduction of livestock, which were sent eastward to the Corn Belt to be fattened on more carbohydrate-rich feeds such as corn. It was the lime and humus-rich soils of the Great Plains, once broken by the plow and connected to distant markets, that provided the high-protein hard wheats preferred for bread making. Wheat grown further east were lower in protein and softer. So this has changed, of course, but this is from a book published in 1952. It just gives you a general idea. A lot of these ideas were corroborated. Okay. And turning southward, with the exception of such areas as the fertile Appalachian limestone valleys, the highly leached soils of the southeast produced mainly carbonaceous products such as cotton, corn, sugar, and timber. So Albrecht's nutritional geography was corroborated by a growing body of research on differences in nutritional qualities of foods due to variations in soil fertility, climate, and other such environmental factors. In 1948, for instance, Rutgers University soil scientist Furman Baer, who also came up earlier, published the results of an extensive survey called Regional Variations in the Mineral Composition of Vegetables that more or less confirmed Albrecht's nutritional geography. The study and others later on showed that as one moved from west to east and north to south across the continent, the mineral and protein density of crops generally declined. Though, of course, fertilization and cultural practices on a particular farm could create major variations from this trend, but the trend was clear. Interestingly, rates of dental decay among World War II draftees also mapped on the pattern of soil fertility, and this is something that Albrecht brought up. This isn't very clear either. But you can see on the top here, the number of cavities per person decreased as you got closer to the plains, and then it slightly increased as you went away from them to different soil types. So what was emerging from this research straddling nutrition, agronomy, and soil science was a novel perspective that I would call nutritional ecology. I make up a lot of these words, I guess. In a general sense, nutrition scientists of the 1910s to 1940s were battling against the starchification or sugarization of the diet. Its demineralization is another way to put it. The industrial food system of that era was very good at delivering crude calories in abundance, but it seemed to be failing qualitatively to nutritional scientists. So a handful of scientists with an eye to both nutrition and agriculture were also raising the alarm on the starchification and demineralization of entire ecosystems. In other words, they saw a connection between eroding soils and eroding bodies. This point was made over and over again. As the opening quote by Price indicated, they were aware of the perverse logic of the long-distance trade in food, wherein minerals were hustled from the world's pastures and fields into waterways as urban toilet flush, basically. John Boyd Orr argued in his 1929 book, Minerals and Pastures, quote, every cargo of beef or milk products, every shipload of bones, leaves the exporting country so much the poorer, unquote. So the failure to follow this rule of return, the argument led to depleted soils, lower yields, animal disease, and foods of declining nutritional quality. And Albrecht also identified a similar trend in the USDA statistics on the protein content of wheat. And basically what the slide shows is the darker the color, the higher the protein content of wheat. And as the years advanced and as more cropping took place and erosion took place, the protein content of wheat was going down. The proportion of carbohydrate in relation to protein and minerals was increasing, even though yields of corn and wheat were going up. Okay, so for some concluding points here, So the first point is that scientists like Albrecht were putting a nutritional on the dire erosion warnings being delivered by the agrarian conservationists in the 1930s. But the newer knowledge of nutrition also reinforced a note of optimism at the time. Reducing the acreage devoted to erosion-promoting field crops such as corn, and increasing the acreage to soil-conserving grasses and legumes, as well as fruit trees and truck crops, would also reduce the chronic glut of grain plaguing farmers in the 1930s. Perhaps contrary to current-day environmentalist sensibilities, the conservation of natural resources was seen in the 1930s as contingent upon spurring mass consumption of high-value animal products and perishable products. The increasing consumption of these protective foods, the argument went, would also be protective of the soil as well as the livelihood of farmers. Beginning this virtuous cycle of soil, economic, and nutritional improvement would require little more than the increased application of mineral amendments and good agronomic technique. Okay, so the second point is that for many mainstream agricultural scientists in that period, no particular priority had to be given to chemical, physical, geological, or biological factors to gain a proper understanding of what goes into making fertile soil and nutrient-dense foods. It was because of this ecological understanding that that leading agronomists in the 1930s promoted what we would consider organic methods. Furthermore, there was nothing particularly unorthodox about the argument that fertile soils tended to produce more nutrient-dense crops and healthier people and animals. This was a tenet of the organic movement as well as the USDA Plant Soil and Nutrition Laboratory that was founded at Cornell University in 1939, and which also exists today under a slightly different name. This was one of the books where this argument was made by Sir Albert Howard. But the similar point about the connection between soil fertility and nutrition were made repeatedly in books that weren't identified with the organic movement per se. This is just a small sampling that I've been able to collect so far. There are many more scientific articles than this, but it showing all the articles would bore the paint off the walls. So, but from its beginning in the 1930s, the organic movement was embroiled in controversy with the scientific establishment. And so I kind of wondered why this happened if they had so many similarities. From my reading of the early controversies between these camps, it seems that most of the early disagreement arose over differences in emphasis rather than over the science. There was some scientific difference, but not the major problem. Because agronomists in the 1920s and 30s stressed grasses and legumes, they focused on mineral amendments such as lime, gypsum, and rock phosphate to cheaply provide calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, sulfur, et cetera, required for these crops. Synthetic NPK fertilizers, which became the bugbear of the organic movement very early on, were quite peripheral in the view of mainstream agronomists in the 1930s, but not as was the case with the organic movement out of a sense of principled animosity. To figures like Albrecht, increasing soil humus content and the quality of the food supply was predicated first on providing minerals to plants and soil microorganisms to make up for previous losses. Moreover, reflecting the strongly geographical vision of soil science of that era that I brought up before, mineral amendments were seen as necessary in the vast regions of the planet that did not contain enough of them in their native condition in the first place for highly demanding crops and animals. The ecology of the grasslands and prairies had, in effect, to be expanded to feed the modern civilized world. Early organic farming advocates generally agreed that mineral amendments were beneficial, but they placed greater priority on building fertility with organic matter, and they voiced skepticism towards dependence on the fertilizer industry and industry more generally. So here's that difference of emphasis. And this difference of emphasis can also be seen and the fact that Sir Albert Howard, who was trained as a mycologist, often mentioned the forest and not the grassland or the prairie as the ideal of how a properly functioning farm should work, the natural ideal toward which it should work. The organic farming movement was also less squeamish about mixing scientific and philosophical concepts. Organic farming first got its name from Lord Northbourne in his 1940 book, Look to the Land, in which he outlined the idea of the farm as an organic whole in a metaphorical sense, to refer to the complex interrelationship of parts similar to a living organism, which included the farmer. In Organic Movement publications, the ones I've read so far at least, similar blending occurred with such terms as chemical, devitalization, natural, and artificial. This helped to mobilize popular support, but it greatly antagonized scientists and created a certain sense of animosity. So I'll just conclude with some remarks about the post-World War II decades. In the post-World War II decades, 1940s and 50s and 60s, the nutritional ecology vision became increasingly anachronistic, even though evidence continued to accumulate in its favor. The use of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides surged, and crop production increased dramatically. So antibiotics, breeding advances, and the development of massive soybean and hybrid corn supplies under heavy subsidy allowed for confinement feeding to replace pasture feeding of animals. And just to emphasize what I said before, pasture feeding and forage feeding of animals was the panacea for nutritional ecologists and agronomists in the 1920s and 30s. So food processing technologies also advanced rapidly, which proved to be a mixed blessing in terms of dietary change and public anxieties about the safety of the food supply. In the post-war decades, in sum, the protective foods became cheaper, though in a manner that could not have been foreseen previously by their proponents. The shared vision linking mainstream nutrition science, government policy, and soil conservation weakened, and in some ways it actually reversed. By the 1960s, due to what is now being recognized as perhaps one of the greatest miscarriages of the scientific process ever, many of the protective foods of the earlier era of nutrition science were branded as artery-clogging agents of death. The carbohydrate, previously regarded with a certain amount of ambivalence by animal and human nutrition scientists, was embraced. To this was added growing concern in the 1960s and 70s about the environmental costs of the Western diet and embrace of vegetarianism. In any case, the organic movement, which had identified itself since its early days by opposition to synthetic fertilizers, poison sprays, the laboratory hermit and the scientific establishment, struck a chord in this new countercultural context. It has only been in recent years that many of the elements of the earlier nutritional ecology perspective have started to seep back into discussions on nutrition and sustainability. And interestingly, contrary to its mainstream origins, much of the impetus for this revival has come from groups outside of institutional science, such as the Weston A. Price Foundation. And speaking of which, I'd like to thank the Weston A. Price Foundation for supporting my travel here. So that's it. Any questions? Sorry, I kind of had to like read off of a script.
I don't take it up to present day. You mentioned carbohydrates were embraced, and yeah. Then more recently they were totally bad.
Right.
So.
Yeah, it seems to be swinging back and forth. Hey. Any other questions?
I didn't quite understand were Albrecht and Price interacting with each other through publications, or was there it sounds like there was this exchange of information, maybe mm-hmm. directly, or was there direct contact?
There was direct contact through several organizations. One of the clearest connections, though, is that Weston Price wrote, his magnum opus is called Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. It was first published in 1939. And in the second edition, Price got a supplement to it. And William Albrecht he contributed the chapter in that supplement, one of the chapters. It was called Food is Fabricated Soil Fertility, where he basically repeats a lot of what I was saying as far as this regional variation and then how regional variations in soil fertility should affect agricultural technique. But beyond that, there's a whole bunch of other connections. Yeah. Any other?
Albrecht and maybe Price, evolved in their relationship to their scientific peers during their careers. I mean, Albrecht mm-hmm. was the president of the Soil Science Society of America
yeah.
at one time, but and the head of his department. Mm-hmm. But I hear various things about how towards the end of his career he was bounced various things that I don't know whether that's, you know, rumor or fact.
Well, what I'm doing is kind of a work in progress. I'm actually reading documents now on the post-war period, but my initial reading is that people like Price and Albrecht continued to be respected by their peers. No one doubted the validity of their science, but I think that there was a large separation between what the good science was and what was actually going on the ground. And after World War II, the distance between what agronomists were recommending and what was actually happening increased. And so people like Albrecht, who were more or less in the mainstream, he had a big chapter in the 1938 USDA Yearbook of Agriculture, but he started to drift more towards the organic movement and the natural eco-agriculture movement, but his position didn't change. It was everything else changed. So that's kind of my short answer to that. Weston Price, I've read the reviews of his books. Again, overwhelming acclaim, except for some of the more moralistic arguments he made about food affecting behavior. But yeah, he was the head of the main research laboratory for the American Dental Association, so I don't know. I haven't totally figured out why yet.